Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Wolf, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
Wolf, the Fed raised the bank rate in the U.S. by 25 basis points on Wednesday, despite the banking crisis. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the Fed did a very interesting thing that was already pioneered by the Bank of England and was confirmed by the European Central Bank. It split into the two separate concepts now. So that's monetary policy, so that's dealing with the economy, with inflation, and then there's, being the lender of last resort to the banks. And so it split these two things completely apart, and Powell, Chair Powell, in his post-meeting press conference explained this. The ECB, so the European Central Bank, explained it last week. The Bank of England actually executed this. So what they're doing is they're following the monetary policies. They're raising interest rates, and they're pursuing quantitative tightening. And they is the Fed, is the European Central Bank, and is the Bank of England. So they're all on that same track. At the same time, they're bailing out, meaning they're providing short-term liquidity to the banking system if it needs it. And by short-term liquidity, the Fed is lending money to the banks at punitive rates. So right now, to borrow at the Fed's discount window, a bank has to pay 5% interest, and they have to post collateral. So that is a very expensive rate for a bank to borrow money. They can get money from their depositors for a lot less, and they don't have to put up collateral. And the same with bonds. They can sell bonds for less than that, and they don't have to post collateral. So this is a punitive rate that banks are being charged for this short-term liquidity, and that's why this will go very, very quickly. They will pay this off as soon as they can, as soon as they got their ducks in order, and they will get the funding somewhere else. And at the same time, this will vanish. This liquidity support, banks will walk away from it because it's too expensive for them. Once they don't need it anymore, once the emergency is gone, they're suffering from a deposit outflow, and that's kind of settled down now. But deposit is a liability for a bank. That's the money it owes its depositors. So when they're pulling it out, the bank loses a liability, but it also loses the cash that comes with it. So that's an asset, and the bank doesn't have that cash to that extent. So that's how they ran into trouble. And the Fed made this liquidity, so cash available to the bank for a punitive rate. And so now the deposit outflow has kind of ended, and this thing is settling down. So I expect the liquidity support to disappear, to vanish, to not be needed in the next few weeks or months. And at the same time, the inflation fight continues. So the Fed's quantitative tightening continues. The long-term bonds are continuing to roll off the balance sheet. And it hiked its rates now for, so it's been doing this for 12 months now. It's hiked by 475 basis points so far. Inflation is here to stay. This kind of inflation doesn't just vanish, and the Fed understands this now, and that's why they separated these two. And You know, and so the inflation fight continues. The Bank of England ran into a problem with its pension funds last fall. And, the UK has 10% inflation, worse than the United States. And so the Bank of England couldn't really back off its quantitative tightening and its rate hikes. So even while it pursued its monetary policy to crack down on inflation, it also lent short-term liquidity support to the government bond market that was going into debt spiral because of the pension funds were forced to sell because one of the strategies has blown up. I mean, it was all over the news last fall, you know. And so the Bank of England stepped in for a few weeks only, bought some bonds in the government bonds in the bond market, and that settled things down. And then in November, December, and early January, it sold those bonds. It got rid of them. And then it pursued quantitative tightening and it hiked rates, including today. And so that's going on. It eliminated the short-term issue of the pension funds. And they took big losses in this. I mean, it didn't bail anything out. It just gave them some breathing room to get the ducks in a row. And then, then it pursued a tightening monetary policy. And the Fed's doing the same thing. This is the new strategy. The European Central Bank did the same thing last week. Credit Suisse was blowing up. And the European Central Bank hiked rates and said it will continue QT. And will provide, if it has to, will provide liquidity support to the banks as a separate issue. And so that's a really important new principle that we're seeing here today. They're separating liquidity issues in the banking system from the fighting inflation part of their job, and they're doing both at the same time. The liquidity support is short-term, it vanishes, it goes away, just like it did with the Bank of England. That was just a short thing, and now it's all gone. And the long-term thing is to fight against inflation, which, the last time we had this kind of inflation, it took over 10 years to get back down. I mean, not even to 2%, to get back down to 5% or 4%, So, inflation like this, when it moved into services, is very difficult to contain, and the Fed understands this, and that's really what they did. That's a very important distinction that we now have. It's official. They're doing that, and the fight against inflation continues.
Could we be entering the eye of the interest rate hurricane?
That's an interesting thing. The hurricane, you think it's kind of calm and after you've been through hell and before you go through hell again. We really haven't been through the hurricane yet. We have seen some issues in the banking system with some banks. It's just a handful of banks that didn't manage the long-term exposure to interest rates very well. Or didn't hedge it at all, and didn't really adjust to it, and so we've got that issue. The economy overall has dealt with these higher interest rates fairly well. The housing market is, of course, taking a big hit, but in terms of employment, in terms of retail sales, in terms of consumer spending, in terms of businesses spending, this really has held up amazingly well. That slowdown that the Fed is trying to engineer, I mean, the economy is no longer growing like it used to, but it's still growing, and based in part on the strength of the consumer and despite the issues in the housing market. So it is fairly calm. It's amazingly calm out there. And so the eye of the hurricane may be an apt analogy because, sooner or later, it's going to probably get shakier. But right now, the economy is amazingly calm, and consumers are spending, and businesses are spending, and hiring is still strong, and unemployment is low, and there's still lots of labor shortages, especially in services, and so we still have these kinds of things, I'm surprised by it. I expected the economy to slow down long before we get to 5% interest rates. Now we're at 5%, and we really don't see that slowdown yet.
What's worse, quantitative tightening or higher interest rates?
What's worse? Jim, that's a leading question. I would call it what's better, quantitative tightening or high interest rates, because after all these years of money printing and the interest rate repression that we've seen, what we really, as an economy, what we really need is quantitative tightening. That the central banks need to undo the money printing that they've done, or at least part of it, and they need to bring interest rates up into some kind of a normal range. And normal means that short-term interest rates are somewhere near or slightly above the rates of inflation. And they're still below the rates of inflation, no matter how we look at it. And quantitative tightening has, you know, it's been going on for a while, but it still hasn't reduced the amount of assets that they've bought over the prior 2 years by a whole lot. I mean, it still hasn't made a huge dent into it. That's why we see inflation continuing to be fueled, you know, because after so much money printing, you just can't shake inflation that much. But so I think they're both good things that the central banks are doing. I support them. I wish that we'd do quantitative tightening faster. So I'm at a point where I think interest rates probably shouldn't go up much more in the United States, so that 5% short-term federal funds rate at the upper end. When they get to 6%, I think there may be some real damage at some point. But quantitative tightening could be sped up. At the same time, we've already got banks that are some banks that are a little shaky. So, you know, there's only so much he can do before something breaks. And of course, what has broken is price stability. That's a big thing. Yeah, that's the biggest thing the Fed is in charge of, price stability, or any central bank is in charge of. And it has broken. It has completely broken. It's in shards. It's spread all over the floor. You know, and so they're trying to put price stability back together. So they're fixing this, and there are going to be minor breakages of other things along the way, like we have some of the banks that were incompetently managed get in trouble. And so I think it right now they're probably on the right track in terms of the pace of quantitative tightening and the interest rate hikes. Once the banking trouble settles down, I think it would be good to speed up quantitative tightening, and then don't raise short-term interest rates above 6%. They may have to go to 6% if inflation isn't slowing down. But at some point, you know, I would rather have long-term rates be pushed up by more quantitative tightening than higher short-term rates.
What do you think the real rate of inflation is?
Well, that really depends on you personally, how you live. So, for example, a homeowner in the United States that has a 30-year fixed rate mortgage means the mortgage payment doesn't change at all for 30 years, and after 30 years, your home is paid off. So over this 30-year period, the main part of the housing costs don't really change for that homeowner. What changes are property taxes and insurance and maintenance and repairs and that kind of stuff. But the main part of home ownership doesn't change, so that's fixed. So there's no inflation in that for that particular household. If you didn't buy a used car in the last couple of years, you didn't really get hit by the used car inflation. Yeah. But if you had to buy a used car and you rent in a place where they have a lot of rent inflation, yeah, you got a very substantive hit by inflation. Yeah, so it really depends on how you live. In some cities like San Francisco, inflation really isn't the bigger of a problem because we've lost a lot of jobs and people really we've lost a lot of people. I'm not sure we've lost jobs, but we've lost a lot of people leaving. And so, you know, rents really haven't gone up. They've gone down some. And if you live in another hot spot somewhere in rents, you know, you might have had a 15% rent increase year over year after a 10% rent increase the prior year. And so your inflation picture is going to look very different. So it's really hard to say what the real inflation rate is. I think on a national average basis, I think the range of 6 to 8% in the United States, and that's where some of our indices are, the higher ones, you know, the lower ones are below that. I think that's pretty realistic as a national average. But doubtlessly, some households are facing 15 or 20% inflation in a particular year, and there are others that actually face deflation. I bought some electronic equipment. I bought a big computer screen and some other stuff I needed, and I was going to buy it in 2021, and I had trouble getting it, and the prices, they were gouging me on price. So now they're all on sale. They're all down. They're the lowest prices ever. You know, so I saw deflation in my expenditures because I spent some money on electronic equipment that I needed for my company that had come down a lot. So, you know, used car prices are coming down. You know, this is the thing, you know. Used car prices are now down from a year ago. And all the indices show that, and on the retail side. And so there's a lot of different things that that complicate that picture, but I think 6 to 8% in the United States as a national average is probably fairly realistic.
How far have used car and light truck prices dropped, and is that trend going to continue?
Yeah, so retail prices have dropped for a year in the United States. They've dropped by a lot. And of course they have dropped from this huge, incredible, crazy, you know, worst ever spike in history, you know, that we went through the pandemic, when used car prices spiked by, you know, 40% year over year. It's just incredible what happened. And so, they have come off the spike by quite a big margin, but they're still way above where they used to be a couple of years ago or 2-3 years ago. Yeah, so they're probably not going back down all the way, but they've come down a lot recently. Now, the interesting thing is that on the wholesale side, so the auctions where rental car companies sell the rental units and where the lease return vehicles are sold and where the repos are sold at these auctions, we have seen now the third month in a row of price increases, and March will be the fourth month. So the mid-month data already shows that the price is further increased at the auction. So these are wholesale prices. This is what dealers are paying to restock the inventory. So dealers are now bidding up those wholesale prices. And this is really strange for me, you know. I know this business, and the dealers are squeezing the margin, you know. So they're bidding up wholesale prices. So that's the cost that goes up. At the same time, you know, they're having trouble on the retail side maintaining the price level. So they're giving up margin on when they sell these cars. And that's a very interesting phenomenon. So the dealer profit margins, the gross profit margins, so per vehicles, they're getting squeezed. And so we have higher wholesale prices. They've been coming down. They've been coming up for 3 months, and we've got dropping retail prices. But these profit margins, these per vehicle profit margins, were so huge during this, you know, spike in these cars that we've had, and so obscene, really, that what dealers are now doing, actually, they're kind of going back towards the old normal. They still have fat profit margins, even though they've lowered their prices and on the retail side to get more volume and to get more inventory. They're bidding up the prices at the auction, and so their gross profit margin is shrinking, but it's still fat. You know, that have come down to these record gross profit margins, and so they're now shrinking them down a little bit because they want the volume. Used vehicle volume has slowed down, and the sales volume, in addition, you know, they're a little short on inventory, so now they're restocking, and they're paying and they're driving up auction prices. So this is a really interesting thing, because normally 2 or 3 months from the increase in the auction prices, we see the retail prices increase in the consumer price indices, and that hasn't happened yet. You know, they haven't picked up this yet, and so maybe and what we see from the asking prices, the data that we have, dealers really haven't been able to raise the prices on used cars, and we may have to. Yeah, you know, this is something unusual. And I'm going to keep my eye on this, but there may be indications that the price drops are slowing on the retail side, but I will believe that when I see it. Right now, it's dealers accepting that the margins are getting squeezed in order for them to get the sales volume they want and in order for them to get the inventory they want. And so it's their margins, it looks like they're going back to some kind of normal levels now.
We'll have more with Wolf Richter right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Wolf Richter. Wolf, if more and more people are moving into electric vehicles, what happens to all the new and used internal combustion engine vehicles?
Well, yeah, automakers are already preparing for that. And so you've heard announcements by Ford Motor Company recently where they're splitting the financial reporting into two separate segments, so for EV vehicles and then for the ICE vehicles. And they're spending a gazillion dollars developing EVs and building production facilities and building their supply chains for them. They have to do all that from scratch. There's very little overlap. So they have to build all that up. It took Tesla 10 years to do that, to get up to volume. Now Tesla has the volume. Tesla has the fattest profit margins in the entire auto industry now that it's got that straightened up, because EVs are really cheaper to build. And Tesla's cut its prices. It's putting pressure on Ford and others. They've cut the prices on EVs now. And automakers are shifting over, and they're already laying. So Ford has laid off people in its ICE division, and it's hiring in its EV division. So they're starting to slow down the development of ICE vehicles. They're not coming out with any more new models there. Yeah, all the new development is on the EV side. And so the automakers, they have many years to do this. Now, this is gradually shifting over. And so they will follow demand. You know, when demand for ICE vehicles drops, you know, they will produce less. And then price will solve all demand problems. You know, if you have trouble selling something, you cut the price and it'll sell. So that's eventually what they will face. You know, they will have to find where the demand is and get the price points down there, and then they will sell. I mean, that's in the auto industry, is an old rule. You know, you can sell anything if the price is right. So those sales will continue. There may have to be adjustments on the price. In terms of used vehicles, it's the same. You know, you will eventually have a declining demand for ICE vehicles that are used, and then price will solve that. They'll become cheap enough to will people buy them, and that's how they will work.
Wolf, now I'm hearing some car dealerships that have asked for deposits on electric vehicles. The vehicle arrives, and then they go and charge the customer another $8,000 above asking price, saying, oh, there's supply shortages, this is a special supply fee. What should a consumer do when all of a sudden you're faced with an extra $8,000 on top of what you expected to pay?
Oh, gosh. You know, I mean, there are unscrupulous dealers everywhere. A decent dealer would never do that. Yeah, the price that you negotiate, I mean, it could be that you'd have to see the documents that there really wasn't any kind of deal made. There was just kind of a salesman saying, yeah, I'll call you when we get the unit in and whatever. Yeah, but if it's a pre-sold unit, they need to stick to the terms of the deal. And if the dealer wants $8,000 more, you walk away. You know, you just walk away. There's no reason to do this. You have to, there's other things you can buy, the other dealers you can go to. There is no, the same with when we had these big price surges in new vehicles. A couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, or even a year ago still, dealers were charging $25,000 over sticker to sell something. The solution to that is you don't buy it. Do you go on a buyer strike? And when enough people do that, the dealers cannot sell those units and they will stop doing it. And that has happened to some extent. I mean, new vehicle sales have plunged. People just walked away. They said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not paying $25,000 over sticker. And the same thing when you order a vehicle and you have a price quote that's a firm price quote and then the dealer says, well, it gives you some story. Well, it's $8,000 more, because of yada, yada, yada. You walk away. You don't let this kind of stuff be played on you, and everybody needs to do that, and the dealers will stop playing those kind of games.
Do you have to get these offers in writing to force them to do that? Because, a verbal agreement is only as good as the paper it's not written on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you just have a salesman tell you it's going to be $30,000 to $40,000 or $50,000 when the unit gets in, and he tells you that, and there's no deal then. Yeah, so that's a different story. But if they're still on $8,000 over sticker, you still walk away. You should never buy a new car over sticker. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And there should be a buyer strike. And, when you're getting gouged like that, you walk away. That's just a ground rule in the car business. And during the pandemic, most of the time it works that way, but during the pandemic, people got a lot of free money. And they just bought whatever and paid whatever, and they didn't really care. And that's when dealers got away with these addendum stickers and all these other stuff that they were doing. And the profits in the auto industry because of this were gigantic. I mean, record-breaking gigantic profits. And consumers enabled them because they had all this free money and they didn't walk away. If you as a consumer face this, you need to walk out. That's just the ground rule. You don't have to be obscene to the salesman. I mean, you can be, but you don't need to be. But you just walk out. You don't need to expose yourself to this kind of treatment.
Wolf, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. If you have any questions for Wolf or any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.